Welcome to the Offshore Wind Podcast, hosted by Stuart Mullen and David Lenti. Offshore wind is one of the world's fastest growing energy sources, with strong year-on-year growth expected across the next few decades. Many nations are banking on offshore wind to play a major role in reaching their net zero and sustainability targets and helping their economies recover from the COVID-19 crisis. On the technology front, turbines are bigger and more powerful than ever. Offshore wind farm capacity factors continue to rise, and we're seeing a surge of interest from oil and gas giants seeking to transition their businesses away from fossil fuels, as well as increased competition from the developers who have championed offshore wind from day one. New markets in Asia, the Americas, and eventually Africa, accelerated growth in Europe, the rise of floating offshore wind, and increasing interest in power-to-X and green hydrogen solutions are creating the basis for offshore wind to power the global energy transition. The Offshore Wind Podcast series looks at the issues facing the offshore wind industry today and tomorrow.
Good afternoon, listeners, and welcome to the Offshore Wind Podcast. My name's Stuart Mullen. I'm the Chief Operating Officer at the Global Wind Energy Council, and I'm here at the desk, as always, with Mr. David Lenti, the comms lead and from Corporate Operations and Governance at Siemens Gamesa Renewable Energy. Hello, David.
Hello, Stuart. Another great day here at Mullen Road Studios. And may I commend the staff around here, because as it's so warm, the drinks are very cool. The pool outside in the back is looking absolutely lovely. Flowers look great, as always. Top notch.
Yes, we like the opulent conditions. We have a very special guest today joining us, David, and someone that I met at least half a dozen years ago and I've known of for some time in the industry. We have Mr. Stephen Bull, the EVP of Strategy, Portfolio and Sustainability, Aker Solutions. Hello, Stephen.
Hello, Stuart. Hello, David. It's great to be here.
Thank you very much for joining us. We are very much looking forward to having you on the program. Before we get into the program, the main body, we wanted to speak to you a little bit about your background and how you got to where you are in life or in the offshore wind industry. How did you end up working in offshore wind?
Well, I suppose it's the embarrassing thing is I never really had a full plan for this kind of thing. So I can't look back and say that this is the grand plan over the last 25 years. But what I can do is I'll just give a little bit of a tweak on the background. I finished up university quite a few years ago in London, and the first job I got out of university was actually in the Department for Education, and that was working as a researcher, and that was looking into white working class kids in East London schools to understand why they were actually underperforming compared to other kids from different types of backgrounds. So that was an observational research work that we did for some time, which was really interesting. But I thought, you know, I'm not sure if I can do this forever. Suddenly out of the blue came an offer to work in JP Morgan, an investment bank, not because I had any particular banking background or finance. It was just they needed people who understood numbers and statistics. So I came in and started working there for a while. That was interesting, fun, and relatively well paid compared to my lowly civil service salary. And then after a while, I decided actually to move over to Norway. My wife's Norwegian, so we took the move across there. And then the first job I got there was in Norsk Hydro. And Hydro at the time was a company, had both fertilizer, it had aluminium, and also oil and gas as well, and a large energy trading business. So I started to work there as an analyst on the trading desk. Loved it, fell in love with the energy business. Remember thinking to what's going on in the world of OPEC, to the US shale industry, to, you know, you name it, geopolitics. So that was a great basis for it. And from that, I worked in about 11 years in Norsk Hydro, 13 years I'd worked in Equinor, and just jumped around in different things. And I don't know if it's embarrassing or not, but I've had to say about 12 different jobs in 23 years. So I do have a tendency to jump around and try new stuff. That's my only career advice.
Yeah, that's fantastic. I would be fascinated to hear about the statistical work, and also maybe this gives you great insight into creating pathways for the just transition back in the day. Maybe things come full circle where you actually know what it's going to take to develop some of these pathways for disadvantaged people in major capital cities. But getting back to, I think when we first met for the first time, Stephen, that was when you and Benj Syk from Ørsted had called the industry, or convened industry, to form the Ocean Renewable Energy Action Coalition, better known as ORIAC in the industry, which was, I believe, was meant to pull together some input for the Sustainable Oceans Panel, which ended up being actually delayed because of COVID. But the ORIAC, as it was, really kind of formed the basis of the genesis for a lot of work that we're seeing today.
Definitely. No, ORIAC is a bit of a mouthful, isn't it? ORIAC, yeah. Ocean Renewable Energy Action Coalition. Yeah, I don't think we could find anything else better to call it. But Benj contacted me, Benj Sykes from Ørsted, who contacted me. And Benj also was on the Renewable UK board as well. So we knew each other well. But also coming from Equinor and Ørsted, where, you know, capacity for this type of work is something that is encouraged to try and take, you know, some industry leadership. And that was a, you know, a fantastic place to really try and find and develop a playbook for countries that have not developed an offshore wind regulatory regime. So I think all the exciting things that are going on in, you know, Philippines, Vietnam, Australia, et cetera, where they don't have an offshore wind industry like we have in Europe, it was really, how do we actually jumpstart that possibility and also learn from some of the possible, you know, the good things and also the bad things that we've learned ourselves in Europe. So that was something we're really, you know, happy about, and also particularly extremely excited that GWEC really took this on further as well and really built on it.
Yeah, so just on that, GWEC has worked with the Danish government and IRENA to form the Global Offshore Wind Alliance, which is pretty much the continuation of what ORIAC set out to do initially, and also as a spin-off to that, a technical assistance program called the Ocean Energy Pathway Initiative, which looks at the acceleration and uptake of offshore wind, the Global Offshore Wind Alliance will focus on things like, you know, maritime spatial planning, etc., like all the traditional common challenges that we'll probably talk about a lot of those today, hopefully, in the offshore wind podcast. But it tends to look at those and try to find some commonalities and common ground for governments to solve these challenges. So, I mean, it's still in its infancy, but we're very buoyed by the amount of traction that it's getting within government at the moment. Before we, to round that out, one of the things that we wanted to speak to you today about was you wrote a opinion piece for Recharge, I think it was, a couple of months ago now, talking about the wind industry and in particular how you viewed the wind industry. And we wanted to delve a little bit into some of those topics. You mentioned three things in particular, among them the when we're in an area or a time of huge growth in terms of targets, how can it be that the industry is not making any money, and how does the industry remain competitive? What's your general view of the industry, the offshore wind industry today?
I think, you know, as I say, it's an embarrassment of riches when it comes to the gigawatt targets. You know, we've really seen that, you know, it's all about the offshore wind being as astounded, even the most skeptical of people around the cost structure, that we've really just driven it right down. And it could be one of the most competitive, you know, green energy sources in the world and out competing fossil fuels in many, many areas. And obviously that triggers governments to think this is an exciting technology tool that which they can also use in their energy transition toolbox. The problem about it is that it's been a victim of its own success. So auctions have driven our costs dramatically. It's been highly competitive. You can see many new players wanted to come into the industry. But also, given the situation with now, even just after COVID, when costs started to increase quite dramatically, all prices were on the up. And then the invasion of Ukraine by Russia sent that into a spiral completely. And we've come to a point where, you know, it costs basically 20 to 40% higher to develop an offshore wind project today than it did about 3 to 4 years ago. And that the market hasn't moved on yet. Contract terms haven't, auction prices haven't, strike prices. And it's about, this is the broken model essentially, is that, you know, we have this great opportunity, but the market, you know, it's not a sustainable business today financially.
David?
Yeah, thanks. Thanks, Tim, for that explanation. And so one of the things I think I would like to ask you, Omar, about, that was just one of the views about what's broken and so on. What insight do you have from your background, formerly Equinor, so on and so forth, moving on to your position at Aker Horizons, where you might see things from both sides and a little bit of a differentiation?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it's becoming, you know, been working as a developer for so long, right, and you know, sitting on the other side of the table negotiating contracts with Vestas and Siemens Gamesa and all our friends in the industry. And then I find myself sitting on the other side of the table trying to work back on sustainable margins for ourselves. So admittedly, it's a healthy thing to do. I would say going from developer to supply chain and back and forth is something career-wise I would recommend, because you do get another perspective on the industry and particularly, you know, how we work the margin side of it. But what I have seen is that when we break down offshore wind developments and I look at all the contract structures, and you think of a classic multi-contracting strategy where they've split the turbine, the cable, transmission, et cetera, all broken into different packages. I think what I find is not really sustainable with that type of approach is that there is still so much contingency, maybe profit on profit margin being squeezed in there because all the supply chain is being brought in so late and essentially just pulling together these packages. And what you find is that compared to an oil and gas development where you actually do get a lot more of the supply chain, and particularly if you're developing technology, you get them in the room much earlier and you get them together. So actually working together across the supply chain towards a developer is a better approach than actually this sort of race to the bottom competitive structure you can sometimes see.
Is that a relatively new thing? I remember in the early days of my experience in offshore wind, particularly in the UK, what would happen would be a developer and, for example, a turbine manufacturer would join together pre-bid, then they would optimize their bid and then bid for the auction, and then they'd be successful or not. But you choose a turbine manufacturer to start with, and you kind of be partnering here. Whereas I get the feeling in recent times, it's more like, okay, we'll work out what we want to do from a business strategy point of view. Then we'll work out which turbine manufacturer, which cable supplier, or whatever can fit our business model, and then that puts that undue price pressure on. Is that an accurate assessment, or am I being a bit naive?
No, you know, I think it's an accurate assessment, Stuart. And you know, I've seen that development myself over, you know, the 10 years I've been working in offshore wind, is that different types of cooperation structures, because I think when you're an earlier developer and you don't know the technology so well, you'll invest more time in that. And as you start to mature your own understanding internally, then you start to sort of pick and choose from the market. You know, you're trying to think, okay, let's just take an off the shelf, or that you're essentially, some developers would, you know, obviously you're trying to find the best turbine they can, the largest size that you can. And it's that little bit of the arms race you've had in terms of turbine size has been, you know, actually debilitating for many parts of the industry, that you're always trying a new turbine, something higher each time. And it means that suddenly those who are selling one with a 1 megawatt less has lost all their market share for new projects. So you can see this in floating. It's a bit like that as well, where, you know, the technology is early phase and you'll see a more open type of discussion, conciliatory type of discussion with developers in the supply chain than I do see in offshore wind. But that is turning around.
What do you consider, and I know you're not on the developer side, as you said, anymore, but would you consider, if you hypothetically were, going with a smaller capacity machine if you had a choice between, let's say, company A and company B, all things otherwise equal?
No, I suppose this is like kind of the exciting discussion that will be going at the moment. I think when you see particularly the European offshore wind turbine manufacturers, you know, GE, Siemens Gamesa and Vestas, as you know, there will be different sizes on the turbines while we'll be jumping one from another. But it's so important to actually us in the industry to understand that this cost out model is so important, because the EBIT margins today of all those three OEMs, you know, the original equipment manufacturers, is just not looking good at all. We've seen that for the last 6 months, and we've seen a tip up, which hopefully is improved a little bit more. But we have to try and find as well, is that the industry has to understand, how can we standardize more? How can we actually, you know, work better across there? But also, how do you actually, in a European perspective, not just protect, but make those competitive turbine manufacturers with a sustainable long-term business model? Because, you know, it's the workhorse of the offshore wind sector, and we, you know, we fit in everything around that. But at some point, we, you know, we might have to just say, you know, do we need to keep growing more? As you say, could we just stick with a 15 megawatt and that's okay? Do a cost out model, sweat it out the business as much as we can, and then we don't have to adjust everything else in terms of installation vessels or monopulse, you know, sizes, because everything's just getting bigger and bigger, and then we have to kind of refit the whole model again. And I'm sure that we should be doing that right now. It's you know, we are in an incredibly competitive place already when it comes to cost of energy. You know, just, we have to understand that, that's it. You know, we've hit a sweet spot in terms of that, when we just need to raise that up so it matches the market better.
Correct. The cost of energy may be very, very good, but when the cost of your entire machine and your projects and so on continue to grow exponentially without some of your other deliverables following suit, then that's how we end up in a situation where the three biggest ones are absolutely in the red.
But maybe a question for you then, David. Maybe a question for you is, I mean, if you look at that, then, you know, the ROI, the return on investment for your investment in a new turbine, if you look at what's happened over the last 10 years, you know, turbine sizes have increased exponentially. If you, GWIC has a nice little graph in it from our market intel area that actually shows the release of a new turbine models, et cetera, and how often they're being released quicker than iPhones, you know, like they're, you know, someone either goes a little bit higher, like there's a greater boilerplate or nameplate capacity, the blade gets a bit bigger. It's been continual innovation. And Stephen, I think you mentioned it a little bit, sort of like, are these just like a race to the bottom of these things? And if we can't amortize the investment over the volume.
Entire life cycle, ideally, of machines, correct.
Yeah, no, I mean the entire volumes, because, I mean, if you look at...
Oh, yes, pardon me.
If, for example, you use that traditional analogy of it takes 100 units to get a factory, et cetera, you know, back in the, you know, 10 years ago, it was a 2-megawatt machine that you could install both on and offshore, and so you could, you know, you could always fill your factory slots. Now, if we're talking about a 15-megawatt machine, that's 1.5 gigawatt times three if there's three Western manufacturers, plus if the Chinese manufacturers come on board as well. And Stephen, I'd like to get your impression on about those guys in a sec as well. But I mean, you know, that's a lot of volume in a particular market. I mean, there's no one market that can really sustain that growth, even the most in the most prosperous of times.
It is a lot of volume, and it is a lot of markets, or one market or several markets. But we see, you know, the growth plans. We see the extremely ambitious political targets that sound wonderful, and it's great for that, you know, 1.5 minute clip on the TV news in the evening, where the reality, as we all know, becomes challenging is executing. It's moving these targets to concrete, profitable orders for everyone, from the developer side, from the OEM side, from the supply chain side, the value chain, the ports, the harbors, the people, the training, the sustainability part, which we also need to get into, and of course, the safety and the regular employee side of stuff. That is absolutely a challenge that all of us admit to. If we just move back a little bit about, as was discussed, this massive growth and this massive exchange or change from turbine capacity, and it's public knowledge, it doesn't take a lot of desk research to see that from a Siemens Gamesa side, we went from a 6-megawatt machine offshore that was launched in 2011 to a 10-megawatt machine being launched in early 2019. So we had almost 8 years to add 4 megawatts of capacity, right? So 8 years, 4 megawatts. We then went from launching the 10-megawatt machine as the competitors, as GE is launching machines, as Vestas is launching machines, all, you know, pleasant, intelligent people. We went from a 10-megawatt machine to a 14-megawatt machine from 2019 to 2021, later on. So we added 4 megawatts of capacity in less than a year and a half, from 8 years to a year and a half for the, in theory, mathematical 4-megawatt capacity increase.
Well, that's
so how is anyone supposed to keep up with that? I mean, we could, obviously, we can make the machine, and the technology has grown since then. However, as you know, we were talking about, it does put enormous pressure, as Stephen said, on the quote, rest of the supply chain, the vessels, the ports, and so on and so forth. So,
yeah, okay. I mean, Stephen, do you have an opinion about that, and particularly maybe the lack of increase in the number of units that that the industry sold, or maybe, because, you know, talking about megawatts is one thing, but if it's the same number of units, as that doesn't grow at all, then you don't get scale of any, and you can't really build out your supply chain underneath that.
I agree. I think, again, it's we've seen post COVID that having a supply chain, having yards, having factories is not a nice to have. It's a must have in global terms. And this is essentially security of supply is not just about security of supply for electrons or for hydrocarbons around the world. It's also security of supply. You can actually build stuff yourself. So I think the US understands this fully, obviously, with the Inflation Reduction Act. We can see that with the European Union as well. So to actually realize there's an industrialization aspect around this, which is incredibly important in the future, because you cannot rely on certain regimes, simple as that, for energy supply. So you need to build that yourself. And again, that takes time to do it. And it's actually, how do we find those investments? I mean, we still have to have the elements of globalization. We need, there is positive, amazingly positive things about globalization, to drive down costs. Yeah. But to have certain fundamental elements around your supply chain that can be domestic, or at least, sort of from a national area, that's really important. And that's something where it comes to like this non-price criteria. How do you square that up in terms of local content for one country versus, for example, the European Union? Those points there, is that these are something where it's a new policy dimension that needs to take into account of that.
Can you tell us, Stephen, a little bit more what specifically you mean by non-price criteria?
And this, sometimes it's also called qualitative criteria. So rather than it just being essentially a full open market, you can essentially deliver an auction price at a certain X euros per megawatt hour. This actually will have some contingencies that you will have to produce, for example, a certain amount in a certain country. It could be within the European Union. It could be a single country. Or you could start putting elements where you should be having elements of sustainability, working with small, medium-sized enterprises. You need a certain amount of money or funding towards, for example, skills or development or just transition. So you start to add other elements that are not just about price. And then you can score those elements there. So you can have a certain percentage of scoring on a qualitative criteria, and the rest can go towards the levelized cost of energy. So you can balance out competitiveness of cost of energy and a global supply chain. You can't have one country just making all this stuff, but you can pick certain things. And that's important when it comes to actually not just to actually how do we build things in Europe and actually reshore the business a lot more. Same with the US as well. But it's always important in terms of actually acceptability of offshore wind. And the thing is that, at some point, a time where we've seen growth in offshore wind, particularly in the UK, I think 76% of people polled support offshore wind. It's a positive thing there. Yep. But it could be in certain countries that people do not like this at all. They don't see the benefits for themselves. They don't see the jobs. They don't see the right investment. So you have to get that balance right. And particularly if we're going to be putting hundreds of gigawatts of offshore wind around the world, you need local people to help support that.
I mean, some of the non-price criteria around the world that we have seen, it tends to end up in a little bit of a beauty contest sometimes. And it tends to be, it's not always as transparent as like the weighting criteria for each of the non-price criteria. It differs, and of course, different governments will put different weightings on different parts of the pieces of the puzzle. But I mean, what we don't want to see is bids not being able to be separated and awards being won on a coin toss. Special shout out to RWE and the Danish auctions, but good luck to them.
Let's also give a shout out to the turbines that they chose for that Danish auction at the Thor project. That would be a Siemens Gamesa 14 megawatt machine. Just throwing that in there.
Yeah, okay. It's not an infomercial, mate, but okay.
Stuart, I got to pay the rent somehow, right?
Yeah, right. No, but Stephen, I'd be interested to hear your take about how we get more transparency in this, and particularly around how we rate this non-price criteria and how we differentiate between those different factors.
I think if you put it in terms of where we are in the industry, if you're in the Netherlands or if you're in Denmark, you can just pick and choose a bit of the supply chain, within, or I wouldn't say a stone's throw away, but definitely not too far away. You've got factories all over, from monopiles to cable to turbines, nacelles, blades, etc. But if you think of, for example, the development in Norway for offshore floating wind, then the floating wind supply chain doesn't really exist so much in any large scale. Particularly when it comes to foundations, there's a different type of cable technology. We will need higher voltage dynamic cable for this, which isn't particularly, at least on the market today or been tested enough. You might need offshore floating transmission, you could use subsea substations. You know, there's different types of AC or, you know, offshore transmission requirements there in several hundred meters of water depth. That stuff doesn't get built essentially on its own. You're saying, yep. So you do need to, just like with the oil and gas industry, you do need to actually try and accelerate this. And you can do that by obviously, you know, sort of forcing local investments there, but to have a balanced approach, which I think the Norwegian authorities have done a good job on when it comes to one area called Utsira, which is on the west coast of Norway, 3x500 megawatt, yep, opportunity for floating wind, yep, but with a clear levelized cost of energy criteria, but also breaking down into qualitative criteria as well, which, okay, generally, you know, from developer to the supply chain, everyone's been very supportive of that approach.
Yeah. Okay. Interesting. I mean, I've personally been, as part of this offshore working group for Australia, we've been working with DQ and also about talking about like what should be in the non-price criteria for the Australian market. And I think that it was great that DQ were really reflective about this, and you know, they really thought about what's going to drive this. But I think it's, you know, after now that the first Gippsland or the Gippsland feasibility study or the first Gippsland license is going to be awarded, it's going to be interesting to see how the industry feeds back into these things. So I think it's really interesting that there's so many markets, particularly around the globe, that's going to have to come and work through these issues and work through these best models, and maybe there's not one size fits all. I don't know how you view maybe some of the other markets outside of Europe.
Yeah, I mean, it's not without its dilemmas. You know, there is no sort of amazing X factor of a particular policy that works for here. So we just say it depends on, for example, Australia. And I know, Stuart, we always have to mention Australia, don't we, in every podcast?
Yeah, exactly.
And good. Now that's a dedicated listener. I am impressed. I mean, he even beat me to the punch on that one. Golly.
But you got to think, joking aside, you got to think, what is Australia good at today in certain industry? And what is relative to, for example, offshore wind? And if I just draw the inference back to Norway, since I'm sitting here now, I mean, Norway's offshore energy service sector, yeah, is the second largest industry after oil and gas sales. So it's about 30% of revenues come from international markets. Wow. You know, it's big. And that's, you know, it comes from the US Gulf of Mexico. It comes from, you know, it comes from Australia. It comes from Asia. It comes, yeah, from Brazil. I mean, this is hardcore, difficult subsea technology in many respects. And this is really what, you know, how would Australia build that? Australia does the same thing. It has massive LNG plants, it has deep water, it has, you know, a lot of manufacturing, obviously mining. Which are the areas, the specific areas that it could, you know, particularly lift itself? It can't do everything and it shouldn't do everything. I mean, there needs to be a balance between what you can get from Korea or from other yards around the world and what you actually could build yourselves locally. And this is what I think Norway's trying to struggle a bit with as well. You know, which are those high value industries in a country with, you know, fairly high labor rates, no problem, because it has obviously a well-developed welfare state. So it's not going to compete in terms of actually, you know, thousands and thousands of blue-collar employees. It has to be a sort of value add there and a technology mention or innovation. And that's what this qualitative criteria needs to tweak in the right way.
It's talking about the unsustainable financial situation that the industry is in. Can you see other things besides just qualitative and criteria to help the current business model and relationship adapt more towards a financially sustainable relationship between the developers, financing sectors, supply chain? What are some ways you can see this could be improved?
Definitely, David. I think there's a few aspects. There are some, you know, there's some light at the end of the tunnel here. Definitely. I mean, again, this is a blip. We'll look back on this thing. Okay, this is pretty tough, but now it's time to sort of get the business back on track. You can see, for example, that recent Ireland had an auction fairly recently, and Ireland is a fairly undeveloped market in terms of offshore wind. It doesn't have the big, you know, huge amounts of megawatts in the water yet. It's had experimental stuff, but that came in €86 a megawatt hour. You know, that was a sort of, you know, an okay price, I think, with the industry. I think if that was probably a few years ago, it might have come in at 50 or maybe 60. But that, you know, that's a price that probably better reflects the issues in the supply chain at the moment and a brand new market as well. You know, the supply chain isn't there on your doorstep immediately in Ireland. Yeah. Same way for Norway. Norway's given 15 billion NOK to an area called Sørlige Nordsjø II, which is a, you know, fixed bottom area between Denmark and Norway. the industry just said, you know what, 15 billion, I'm sorry, it's not very much. It's, you know, nobody's going to turn up in the auction to do this. And it raised it to 23 billion. Wow. So, you know, governments are listening to industry, which is positive.
Yeah. And 23 billion or 15 billion NOK, you mentioned? NOK.
Yeah.
Meaning?
No, it's not euro.
Yeah, Norwegian kroner.
That would be Norwegian.
1.3, roughly. Yeah.
Pardon me? So the currency you were...
Yeah, we're up to about 2.3 billion euros, roughly. So that's
okay,
the support level. Yeah.
Right. So what Norwegian krona you were speaking about.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
NOK, Norwegian krona.
Sorry, yes, thank it was. You. Yeah, Norwegian krona. No DKK and NOK here there.
Very fine.
But the important thing is that the governments are listening in some respects, and I think there's an auction coming up fairly soon in the UK. You know, the next round, it's got a very very low strike price for that one. It's called an administrative strike price. Is it too low for the industry? We'll see. We believe it is too low for the industry. It doesn't reflect the cost inflation there. But you do see some governments talking about top up CFDs. That they might have to give an extra, a few pounds or euros per megawatt hour to an existing contract for difference, because basically that project might not happen, and they want those investments to happen. You know, why not give a few pounds per megawatt hour and have those multi-billion pound investments come through?
Yep.
There's renegotiations with some states in the US. You can see that as well. Some developers looking at those. So there's a change going on here, I think. But I think the important thing about it is also one thing is the government regulatory side of things. Yes, the prices are low, but there is a different way of working. As you mentioned, David, the financial aspect. So bankability terms. I mean, it's more stringent bankability terms and lenders terms and criteria offshore than it is on onshore for wind at the moment, even though it's a very mature business. Interest rates have increased a lot. Risk premiums are up. The weighted average cost of capital for companies is higher as well. And again, these need to be reflected and understood. And particularly if we're going to be lifting offshore wind in countries outside of Europe and outside of the US, I mean, what will be the risk premium you're going to put onto Vietnam or the Philippines and other countries? I mean, we've got to try and avoid the major inflation in the risk there, because this shouldn't be a risky business. We have a supply chain that works.
Interesting. Look, I know, Stephen, we're running rapidly out of time, and I'm not sure if you have a few more minutes with us, or otherwise we could wrap this up now. But I've got about maybe we need to do a part two of this interview, because there's a couple of things. So, first of all, I'd like to touch on the way for allocating seabed, so that we see in some countries that like the US, for example, what seems to the outside observer as extraordinary. Prices to pay for a bit of seabed, and this is at some point the consumer is going to have to pay this back. These prices have to be passed on to the consumer at some stage, and you mentioned that there's going to be some renegotiation, and we saw that Mayflower, I think it was, also they've talked about handing their license back or something, or trying to renegotiate this. So maybe it's changing, but maybe if you could spend a few minutes on those impacts that you see on those huge dividends that governments are getting for their seabed, and is that the best way for governments to profit on this, or can you be more nuanced and still drive an industry development?
You're right that we've seen some eye-watering numbers come through, particularly in the US. The New York Bight areas came in pretty high, and the Carolinas as well. But maybe it wasn't okay. There was some pretty heavy prices also paid for leases in California, but maybe not too bad. Maybe it was, still pretty high, but I think it wasn't completely through the roof. And I think you've seen, I would assume new rounds in the UK as well wouldn't get the same, higher numbers that we've seen previously. I think there's a level of sobriety that has been discussed in the industry to a larger extent, because you say that cost is going to get moved somewhere else. The other part as well is that, particularly for the US, whether it's, BOEM, which is part of the Department of Interior that has the federal lease. I mean, that goes in the federal coffers. It doesn't go to the state.
Exactly.
So again, how do you balance that out between the federal money and the state? And you have something similar in the UK with the Crown Estate. And the Crown Estate, I think, has been quite sensitive to this. The Crown Estate Scotland, which is a different regime to Crown Estate England and Wales, has basically capped it and said that we are more interested in having local content, and you cap at certain levels there. That is an important part. And you can see also with the the Celtic Sea Realm, which is the Crown Estate, which is, you know, between off the coast of Wales, is that they're looking into different ways where they actually could put upfront investments in infrastructure or, you know, to actually de-risk some of those areas, particularly for floating, where you can have different types of ports and logistics in play. So I think there are some, you know, these federal or state level regulatory authorities are, you know, are sensitive to that. Because I think, again, this comes back to actually how do you build this industry and have this not nice to have, but must have for the local supply chain. Just the other part as well is consenting is something you could we could talk for hours about. It's not going fast enough. But yeah. The same with grid. Grid investments are incredibly important. They need to hang together with, obviously, offshore wind developments as well. So there are many elements that will need to be pulled together here.
Yeah. I'd like to touch on a little bit. I'll take you, and maybe we can explore that a little bit in terms of where you see the biggest bottlenecks. And you've mentioned grids, and maybe like vessels is going to be another one that's going to help. But before we get onto that, the impact of negative bidding in auctions, which has been a thing, you know, but can you explain to our listeners first of all the impacts of that and how you see this trend in the future?
Yeah, I mean, we're currently in the process at the moment. There's an auction in Germany going on where essentially everyone's bid and said they were maxed out on the 7 gigawatts, and then they have to try and you can either put everyone into a hat and just pull out the name and, you know, see, you know, hopefully somebody's lucky enough to get that, or you can actually start asking developers to pay for it. And this is what you're doing. Negative bidding essentially is making developers pay for the right to develop a wind farm. You know, generally from an industry point of view, that cost is probably going to get pushed on the consumer somehow, and if it goes into a definitive bidding war or the authorities game it in some sense, then that can put some companies in a very difficult situation. It might mean to me you might better lift that project quickly enough because you put so much DevEx in there or development expenditure in so early. So you actually, that's not the right approach, we don't think. And also it doesn't really do a lot for, you know, you haven't put any criteria down for local content either. Yep. So, but you know, again, it's different strokes for different folks when it comes to these things here. I think if there's one, not just because I'm a Brit, but if there is one particular regime here, and the contract for difference in the UK has been, you know, I think it's probably some of that Wind Europe has also talked about. Giles Dixon has talked about a lot of different things, but contract for difference there, it's stability for the consumer. And it avoids volatility for them, which was godsend during times with particularly after COVID and the invasion of Russia compared to, you know, the power prices we've seen. But also it's 15 years. It's bankable. It's with a private company, with the LCCC, which is their low carbon contract company. So it's a bankable in itself. It's backed by, you know, fully by the Department of Energy. I mean, this is, and it's inflation adjusted. So I think, you know, it's something that has all the bells and whistles that the industry likes. Yep. And also there's an element of flexibility because many developers actually want to have a CFD exposure. They'd like to lock in and project finance for 15 years, but also they'd like some merchant exposure on the top as well, which they can choose. So I think these hybrid models are something that we will see come more and more. And definitely the inflation adjustment around these things is important as well, because we are in a high inflation environment. And I think you might find some developers, you know, get really unstuck if they've not actually got a hedgeable product.
And your experience talking with other governments outside of Europe, do other governments kind of understand that there are, as you say, different strokes for different folks? And do people get that? Or, I mean, because I get the feeling sometimes that people get fixated on a particular model and they try to fit their offshore wind into that particular model. I'm not sure whether you see that in other markets.
Yeah, you do. I mean, this is actually coming a little bit back to ORIAC and, you know, and some of the work that you guys in GWEC do. I mean, you just have to present the different cases for different regulatory environments and what market design looks like as well. And, you know, the UK is an easier market because it's been completely, you know, it's an open market completely. Whereas if you think in France, you know, there's, you know, France is a relatively contained market in a sense. There's only, if you think of power trading between France and Spain, it's only 5% of the electricity. Yep. You know, there's not a lot of interconnectors there. So it does relate to interconnectors, openness of market, et cetera. But what we think, you've got to think in the energy transition itself is that, you know, we're talking just about offshore wind, but we need to talk about, you know, energy efficiency. We need to talk about nuclear. We need to talk about grid. We need to talk about market design. You know, there's all these elements that need to come into play as we electrify, you know, essentially we electrify the world. And I think the you can see some more sophisticated governments are starting to think much more joined up here now in particular. And then that's something that I think we're developing countries, we need to understand those choices as well. So you don't just bring in as much offshore wind as you can. Have you planned enough for grid? Have you planned for storage? Have you planned for, you know, particularly skills and investments in people as well? There's so many other elements here.
Yeah, interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, that fits exactly in line with many of the other messages that we, from a Siemens Gamesa perspective, have expressed here and there. And also that I know colleagues, not competitors in the industry in that regards, have also stressed towards their different governmental affairs contacts and ministries and so on, that it is not simply about the technology and the machine, but it is absolutely 100% about what also is connected at the other, quote, other end of where the power gets generated from the rotor and through the generator and down tower. So,
and just to maybe round it out, just to go back and touch on the supply chain, where do you see the greatest threats and the greatest bottlenecks, and what do you see as the greatest threat to actually the industry being able to deliver on these mouth-watering targets that we see?
Grid number one, okay. Vessels number two, and then you can work your way down, even, you know, turbine, cable. I mean, there's so many different HVDC availability as well for transmission. I mean, there are so many different elements. And at some point, you know, the market will sort itself out. It usually does. But the struggle is that now we can't see where do we make those investments as the supply chain. So again, to stronger pre-commitment, stronger push from developers to pre-commit. A lot of them are doing that in terms of vessels already, no doubt about it. They've done with monopiles. Yeah. So I think the developers do need to do something where to accelerate that, they need to actually commit. And that means that building a longer term relationship to the supply chain. I think that's kind of the key here.
Yeah. Can you see a way around the grid blockage at the moment? I mean, if I look there, it seems that the time that it takes to build out a new grid versus the volume that we know that we need in the market, I'm not sure that there's time enough to build out all the grid that we need to do. Does there need to be some sort of revolution in the grid to actually enable this?
I mean, for grid itself, there is such a ridiculous queue going on at the moment. Uh-huh. You know, it just seems unbelievable. It would probably need a full cleanup, and right. Then you'd really have to align properly between actually, you know, grid and actually when offshore winds are coming online. Because there's been, I mean, especially in the UK, there's been a lot of hedging themselves by just applying for grid application with, you know, no chance at all of probably even developing any megawatts at all. It's more of an option than anything else. So there's a cleanup needs to be happened there. But also you can see in some countries, you know, the TSOs are taking this seriously. Yeah. I mean, they're putting sort of 2 gigawatt at a time transmission offshore, already lining this up there because I know that it's going to get connected at some point with offshore wind. So again, this is something that I think particularly the North Sea cooperation going on at the moment in the European Union, plus Norway and the UK, part of that too, that coordination on between the TSOs is essential.
And one final question from my side, then I'll shut up and let David get a word in, but the hydrogen puzzle and how is green hydrogen going to impact the offshore wind industry and in terms of like additional volume that we expect to see for hydrogen production?
Yeah, it's going to come. It will. It's expensive today. Everybody knows it. But you can see that most of the turbine manufacturers are putting in optionality for smaller scale hydrogen production. I take a bigger view of this one here. I think you could decarbonize gray hydrogen first. Yeah, we need more green. Yes, bring it in there. But I mean, you know, carbon is carbon. If we can actually cut out the CO2 emissions from gray hydrogen today already, that is the lowest hanging fruit, I think. But you're going to see both markets happen for, you know, blue hydrogen and for green as well.
And is that CCS technology you're talking about there?
Carbon capture storage technology. Again, it's the volumes you need for the big steel producers of the world to have enough hydrogen to produce, you know, low carbon steel. And you can generally get that from natural gas, but you're going to have to store it. And you've seen this already. I mean, there's a program itself, but probably not for the offshore wind podcast.
Yeah.
But, you know, major CCS developments going on in Europe where we're seeing the North Sea basin as a storage hub.
Yeah, I've heard.
I mean, it all ties in anyway. So absolutely fine to refer to some other technologies, and it's manufacturing of one thing, it's delivery to someone else, and in the end, as long as we can do what we can to save the environment, protect the planet, and earn ideally some money all across the board, then that's pretty much Can't ask for more than that.
But David, you guys have developed electrolyzers for your turbines. You've got a working model and brand, and this is, you know.
Well, we have developed, yes, a electrolyzing system. So we have the turbine that produces hydrogen. The electrolyzers themselves are not built by Siemens Gamesa, but the concept itself, then the proof of concept, yes, that is an entire project using different sub-suppliers.
Look, I think we have gone way over time here, thanks to some technical glitches at the start of the podcast, which, we run a seamless ship here. We probably shouldn't talk about those to our listeners. We can edit this part out later. But thank you very much, Stephen, for joining us. But before we leave, we always ask our guests, what's caught your attention in the industry of recent times?
I suppose what captures my attention, and I think if in terms of all the clients I speak to, all the big developers, is the big interest in concrete floating foundation. Okay. I think particularly given the capacity to issues you see with steel, the ability that if you create concrete foundations, it could be a spar, it could be a semi-submersible, but you can build this stuff locally. And I think that's really taken a big interest recently. I think, you know, most clients are up there asking, usually, how can we come with different types of solutions for concrete? So that's something you see. I mean, you see it a little bit more in the media. You'll see it probably even more in the future, I would think, as well, because we need a lot of different solutions for floating offshore wind and particularly to hit the local content. So concrete rocks.
Really? Okay. So, I mean, this is really interesting because, I mean, I guess that the whole world is looking to see what type of technology is going to win in this space and where the scale is really going to come from. So I guess that, it's pretty interesting.
It would complement steel. Not going to replace it, it complements it. But it's just about local markets. And I think this is what we want, the innovation we need in the offshore wind space to make it right in certain markets. You know, we've got to think of it differently.
Great. David, what about yourself?
Yeah, so interesting, Stephen. You're talking about suppliers about vessels, etc. So one thing that did catch my eye, which I noticed, was the merger between Cadeler and Eneti to form, according to a couple of news reports, one of the world's biggest wind turbine and foundation installation company. That I found super interesting because, you know, we've seen consolidation on the OEM side, and it's fascinating to me to now see this, if we can call it consolidation, on the different parts of the supply chain. So especially vessels are concerned, where, you know, this fleet will consist of 10 different installation vessels and so on. So that, I think, is a really interesting way to see how the volumes are growing and where things are absolutely aligning as well.
Nice pickup, David, and a big shout out to Mikkel Glirup, who was one of the earlier offshore wind podcasts, probably actually back in season one, I believe he was. And also rounding out the link to Norway, they also floated on the Norwegian Stock Exchange, I think. Cadeler, I think they're a Norwegian Stock Exchange. So well done to all the Cadeler team.
Yeah, shout out to them.
Yeah, and we look forward to seeing them in the APAC region and also in Latin America and how they actually tackle the US. So there's some pretty innovative thinking in that organization, and I'm very keen to see how they actually deal with this.
What about you, Stuart? What has caught your eyes and ears?
Yeah, so on the Global Wind Day, the 15th of June, the wind industry celebrated the passing of the 1 terawatt of installed capacity. And we did that by having an event in central London where we invited the who's who of the industry and of all the pioneers of the industry to come and help us celebrate this momentous occasion, you know. And what's really interesting about it is it took us pretty much 40 years to do the first terawatt, and it'll take us maybe 6 or 7 years to do the next terawatt. I mean, and then, you know, if the figures from IRENA and the IEA are to be believed, the renewables industry has to do 1 terawatt year on year, you know, every year between now and 2050 in order for us to mitigate climate disaster. So it was just a point in time that was worthwhile celebrating, and I was glad to be part of it. And I think that, you know, actually for the three of us here, I think that we've all been in the industry for for some time. And yeah, it was really nice to see. It was great to be able to be with our peers in this space and to hear some of the stories that people told during the night. It was kind of like being at a family birthday party or something, you know, where, where everyone's sharing war stories and stuff. It's really lovely.
Shout out to the entire industry for that one.
Yeah,
onshore and offshore.
Stephen, I don't recall you being there, mate. You're busy that night.
Yeah, well, you know, sometimes I do get busy. You know, I'm trying to sell products and solutions from our company. You know, it's not easy. But what I have to say is that Tim Pick, who is the offshore wind champion for the UK, and really important, any listeners should really, you know, Google it and actually read the report. It's so important because it's so relevant for every market. But when he came into this industry to understand offshore wind particularly, and he said, you know, if you could bottle the energy in this business, you'd make a fortune. And it is incredibly, you know, uplifting. It really is. I've worked across many different energy verticals, but there's something a bit special about offshore wind.
Yeah. How could you leave it on a better note than that? Thank you very much, Stephen, once again for joining us. David.
Thank you.
Yeah, Stephen, thank you. As always, listeners, remember you can find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, or wherever you get your favorite shows.
And if you like what you heard, please leave a review. It actually helps us a lot. We just clicked over the 100,000 downloads. And if you don't like it, David still has the same email address, so please feel free to reach out to him. He always loves dealing with upset listeners. Thank you very much for listening, and catch you next time.
Thank you for listening to the Offshore Wind Podcast, hosted by Stuart Mullen and David Lenti. We hope that you've learned something new today. And if you have any further questions, feel free to send an email to info@gwec.net. The Offshore Wind Podcast is powered by Siemens Gamesa Renewable Energy.